December 16, 2020. 1. Holly gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning. She's packed. She's printed out her Delta ticket. She doesn't have to be at the airport until 7, and it's a short ride, but she can't sleep anymore. She would not, in fact, think she had slept at all except for her Fitbit, which registers 2 hours and 30 minutes. Shallow sleep, and precious little of it, but she's made do on less. She has coffee and a cup of yogurt. Her bag, overhead bin-sized, of course, is waiting by the door. She calls the office and leaves a message for Pete, telling him she won't be in the office today and maybe not for the rest of the week. It's a personal matter. She's about to end the call when something else occurs to her. Please have Jerome tell Barbara that she should watch The Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep, and Harper for the fiction part of her private investigation report. All three movies are in my collection. Jerome knows where I keep the spare key to my apartment. With that done, she opens the recording app on her phone and begins to add to the report she is making for Ralph Anderson. She's starting to believe she may have to send it to him after all. 2. Although Allie Winters is Holly's regular therapist and has been for years, Holly did some research and sought out Carl Morton after she returned from her dark adventures in Oklahoma and Texas. Dr. Morton has written 2 books of case histories similar to those of Oliver Sacks, but too clinical for bestsellerdom. Still, she thought he was the right man. He was relatively close, and so she sought him out. She had 2 50-minute sessions with Morton, enough to recount the complete and unvarnished story of her dealings with the outsider. She didn't care if Dr. Morton believed all, some, or none. The important thing, as far as Holly was concerned, was getting it out before it could grow inside her like a malignant tumor. She didn't go to Allie because she thought it would poison the work the two of them were doing on Holly's other issues, and that was the last thing Holly wanted. There was another reason for going to a secular confessor like Carl Morton. "Have you seen another one like me somewhere?" the outsider had asked. Holly hadn't. Ralph hadn't. But the legends of such creatures, known to Latinos on both sides of the Atlantic as El Cuco, had been around for centuries, so maybe there were others. Maybe there were. 3. Toward the end of their second and last session, Holly said, "May I tell you what I think you think? I know that's very impertinent, but may I?" Morton gave her a smile, probably meant to be encouraging, but which Holly read as indulgent. He wasn't as hard to read as he perhaps liked to believe. "Go right ahead, Holly. This is your time." "Thank you." She had folded her hands. "You must know that at least some of my story is true, because the events were well publicized, from the rape murder of the Peterson boy in Oklahoma to the events, some of them at least, that occurred at the Marysville Hole in Texas. The death of Detective Jack Hoskins from Flint City, Oklahoma, for instance. Am I right?" Morton had nodded. "As for the rest of my story, the shape-changing outsider, and what happened to him in that cave, you believe those are stress-induced delusions. Am I right about that?" "Holly, I wouldn't characterize..." "Oh, spare me the jargon," Holly thought, and then had interrupted him, a thing of which she would have been incapable not so long ago. "It doesn't matter how you characterize it. You're welcome to whatever you believe. But I want something from you, Dr. Morton. You attend lots of conferences and symposiums. I know this because I researched you online." "Holly, aren't we wandering a bit from the subject of your story and your perceptions of that story?" "No," she thought, "because that story is told. What matters is what comes next. I'm hoping it will be nothing, and it probably will be, but it never hurts to be sure. Being sure helps a person sleep better at night. When you go to those conferences and symposiums, I want you to talk about my case. I want you to describe it. Write it up if you like. That would be fine too. I want you to be specific about my belief, which you're welcome to characterize as delusional, that I encountered a creature that renews itself by eating the pain of the dying. Will you do that? And if you ever, ever meet or get an email from a fellow therapist who says he has or had a patient suffering from that exact same delusion, will you give that therapist my name and telephone number? And then, to be gender neutral, which he always strives to be, or her. Morton had frowned. That would hardly be ethical. You're wrong, Holly said. I've checked the law. Talking to another therapist's patient would be unethical, but you can give the therapist my name and number if I give you permission to do so, and I do. Holly waited for his response. 4. She pauses her recording long enough to check the time and get a second cup of coffee. It will give her the jitters and acid indigestion, but she needs it. I saw him thinking it over, Holly says into her phone. I think what tipped the scales was knowing what a good story my story would make in his next book or article or compensated appearance. It did, too. I read one of the articles and looked at one of the conference videos. He changes the locations, and he calls me Carolyn H. But otherwise, it's the whole Megilla. He's especially good when talking about what happened to our perp when I hit him with the happy slapper. That brought gasps from the audience in the video. And I'll give him this. He always ends my part of his lectures by saying he would like to hear from anyone with patients suffering similar delusional fantasies. She pauses to think, then restarts the recording. Dr. Morton called last night. It's been a while, but I knew who it was right away, and I knew it was going to lead back to Ondowski. I remember something else you said once, Ralph. There's evil in the world, but there's also a force for good. You were thinking about the piece of menu you found, the one from a restaurant in Dayton. That fragment linked the murder in Flint City to two similar murders in Ohio. That's how I came to be involved. Just a little scrap of paper that could have easily blown away. Maybe something wanted it to be found. I like to think so, anyway. And maybe that same thing, that force, has something more for me to do, because I can believe the unbelievable. I don't want to, but I can. She stops there and puts her phone in her purse. It's still way early to go to the airport, but she will, anyway. It's just how she rolls. I'll be early to my own funeral, she thinks, and opens her iPad to find the nearest Uber. 5. At 5 in the morning, the cavernous airport terminal is almost completely deserted. When it's filled with travelers, sometimes absolutely bursting at the seams with their chattering bustle, the music floating down from the overhead speakers is barely noticeable. But at this hour, with nothing but the hum of a janitor's floor buffer to compete with, Fleetwood Mac's The Chain sounds not just eerie, but like a harbinger of doom. Nothing is open on the concourse except for Au Bon Pain, but that's good enough for Holly. She resists the temptation to put another coffee on her tray, settles instead for a plastic cup of orange juice and a bagel, and takes the tray to a table at the back. After looking around to make sure no one is close, she is, in fact, the only current customer, she takes out her phone and resumes her report, speaking low and stopping every so often to marshal her thoughts. She still hopes Ralph will never get this. She still hopes that what she thinks may be a monster will only turn out to be a shadow. But if he does get it, she wants to make sure he gets all of it. Especially if she's dead. 6. From Holly Gibney's report to Detective Ralph Anderson. Still December 16th. I'm at the airport. Got here early, so I have some time. Actually, quite a bit. Pause. I think I left off by telling you that I knew Dr. Morton right away. Had him from hello, as the saying is. He said he checked with his lawyer after our last session, out of curiosity, he claimed, to find out if I was correct when I said that putting me in touch with another patient's therapist wouldn't be an ethical breach. It turned out to be a gray area, he said, so I didn't do it, especially since you elected to stop therapy, at least with me. But the call I got yesterday from a Boston psychiatrist named Joel Lieberman made me reconsider. Ralph, Carl Morton has actually had news of another possible outsider for over a year, but he didn't call me. He was timid. As a timid person myself, I can understand that, but it still makes me mad. Probably it shouldn't, because Mr. Bell didn't know about Ondowski then, but it still... Pause. I'm getting ahead of myself, sorry. Let's see if I can keep this in order. In 2018 and 2019, Dr. Joel Lieberman was seeing a patient living in Portland, Maine. This patient took the Down Easter, I assume that's a train, to keep his once-monthly appointments in Boston. The man, Dan Bell, as it turns out, is an elderly gentleman who seemed perfectly rational to Dr. Lieberman, except for his firm belief that he had discovered the existence of a supernatural creature, which he called a psychic vampire. Mr. Bell believed that this creature had been around for a long time, at least 60 years, and perhaps much longer. Lieberman attended a lecture Dr. Morton gave in Boston. Last summer this was, 2019. During his lecture, Dr. Morton discussed the case of Carolyn H. Me, in other words. He asked any attendees who had patients with similar delusions to get in touch with him, as I had asked. Lieberman did. Have you got the picture? Morton talked about my case as I asked him to. He inquired if there were doctors or therapists who'd had patients with similar neurotic convictions, also as I asked him to. But for 16 months, he didn't put me in touch with Lieberman, as I practically implored him to do. His ethical concerns held him back. But there was something more. I'll get to that. Then yesterday, Dr. Lieberman called Dr. Morton again. His patient from Portland had stopped coming in for sessions some time ago, and Lieberman assumed he had seen the last of him. But on the day after the MacCready School explosion, the patient called out of the blue and asked if he could come in for an emergency session. He was extremely distraught, so Lieberman made room for him. The patient, Dan Bell, as I now know, claimed that the MacCready School bombing was the work of this psychic vampire. He stated this unequivocally. He was so upset that Dr. Lieberman thought about an intervention and perhaps even a short involuntary committal. But then the man calmed down and said he needed to discuss his ideas with someone he only knew of as Carolyn H. I need to consult my notes here. Pause. All right, I have them. Here I want to quote Carl Morton as exactly as I can because it's the other reason he hesitated to call me. He said, "It wasn't just ethical concerns that held me back, Holly. There is great danger in putting people with similar delusional ideations together. They have a tendency to reinforce each other, which can deepen neuroses into full-blown psychoses. This is well documented. Then why did you? I asked. Because so much of your story was based on known facts, he said. Because to some degree, it challenged my established belief system. And because Lieberman's patient already knew about you. Not from his therapist, but from an article I wrote about your case in Psychiatric Quarterly. He said Carolyn H. would understand. Do you see what I mean about a possible force for good, Ralph? Dan Bell was reaching out for me, just as I was reaching out for him, and before I could be sure that he even existed. I'll give you Dr. Lieberman's numbers, office, and cell, Dr. Morton said. He'll decide whether or not to put you in touch with his patient. Then he asked if I might also have concerns about the middle school explosion in Pennsylvania. Concerns relating to our discussions in therapy. He was flattering himself on that. There were no discussions. I just talked and Morton listened. I thanked him for getting in touch with me, but I didn't answer his question. I suppose I was still mad that he waited so long to call. Here, there is an audible sigh. Actually, there's no suppose about it. I still need to work on my anger issues. I'll have to stop soon, but it shouldn't take long to finish bringing you up to date. I called Lieberman on his cell because it was evening. I introduced myself as Carolyn H. and asked for his patient's name and contact number. He gave me both, but reluctantly. He said, Mr. Bell is anxious to talk to you, and after careful thought, I've decided to agree. He's very elderly now, and this is in the nature of a last wish. Although I should add that other than his fixation on this so-called psychic vampire, he's not suffering any of the cognitive decline we often see in the elderly. That made me think of my Uncle Henry Ralph, who has Alzheimer's. We had to put him in care last weekend. Thinking about that makes me very sad. Lieberman said that Mr. Bell is 91. And coming to his most recent appointment must have been very difficult for him, even though he had his grandson to assist him. He said that Mr. Bell is suffering from a number of physical ailments, the worst being congestive heart failure. He said that under other circumstances, he might worry that talking to me would reinforce his neurotic fixation and mar the rest of what might otherwise be a fruitful and productive life. But given Mr. Bell's current age and condition, he didn't feel that was much of an issue. Ralph, it may be projection on my part, but I found Dr. Lieberman rather pompous. Still, he said one thing at the end of our conversation that moved me and has stayed with me. He said, This is an old man who is very frightened. Try not to frighten him more than he already is. I don't know if I can do that, Ralph. I'm frightened myself. Pause. This place is filling up, and I should go to my gate, so I'll make this quick. I called Mr. Bell, introducing myself as Carolyn H. He asked for my real name. That was my Rubicon, Ralph, and I crossed it. I said I was Holly Gibney and asked if I might come and see him. He said,
If it's about the school explosion and the thing calling itself Ondowski, as soon as possible.
7. With a change of planes in Boston, Holly arrives at the Portland jetport just before noon. She checks into Embassy Suites and calls Dan Bell's number. The phone rings half a dozen times, long enough for Holly to wonder if the old man has died in the night, leaving her questions about Charles Chet Ondowski unanswered, assuming the old fella actually has some answers. As she's about to end the call, a man picks up, not Dan Bell, a younger man. Hello. This is Holly, she says. Holly Gibney. I was wondering when...
Oh, Ms. Gibney. Now would be fine. Grandpa's having a good day. Actually slept through the night after talking to you, and I can't remember the last time he did that. Do you have the address?
19 Lafayette Street.
That's right. I'm Brad Bell, How soon can you come?
As soon as I can get an Uber. And a sandwich, she thinks. A sandwich would also be good.
8. As she slips into the back seat of the Uber, her phone rings. It's Jerome, wanting to know where she is and what she's doing and if he can help. Holly says she's sorry, but it really is personal. She says she'll tell him later, if she can.
Is it about Uncle Henry?
He asks.
Are you chasing down some kind of treatment option? That's what Pete thinks.
No, not Uncle Henry. Another old man, she thinks. One who might or might not turn out to be Compass Mentis. Jerome, I really can't talk about this.
Okay, as long as you're all right.
It's really a question, and she supposes he's got a right to ask it, because he remembers when she wasn't. I'm fine. And just to prove she hasn't lost the plot, don't forget to tell Barbara about those private detective movies.
Already taken care of, he says.
Tell her she may not be able to use them in her paper, but they will provide valuable background.
Holly pauses and smiles.
Also, they're extremely entertaining.
I'll tell her. And you're sure you're...
Fine, she says. But as she ends the call, she thinks about the man, the thing she and Ralph confronted in the cave, and she shivers. She can barely stand to think of that creature. And if there's another, how can she possibly face it alone?
9. Certainly Holly won't be facing it with Dan Bell, who's all of 80 pounds and sitting in a wheelchair with an oxygen tank clipped to the side. He's a shadow man with a mostly bald skull and dark purple patches under his bright but exhausted eyes. He and his grandson live in a fine old brownstone full of fine old furniture. The living room is airy. The drapes are pulled back to allow in floods of cold December sunlight. Yet the smells under the air freshener, Glade clean linen, if she's not mistaken, remind her inevitably of the smell, stubborn and not to be denied, that she detected wafting into the lobby of the Rolling Hills Elder Care Center. Musterol, Bengay, talcum powder, pee, the approaching end of life. She's shown into Belle's presence by the grandson, a man of about 40 whose dress and mannerisms seem curiously old-fashioned, almost courtly. The hall is lined with half a dozen framed pencil drawings, full-face portraits of 4 men and 2 women, all good and all surely done by the same hand. They strike her as an odd introduction to the house. Most of the subjects look rather skeevy. There's a much larger picture over the fireplace in the living room, where a small and cozy fire has been kindled. This one, an oil painting, shows a beautiful young woman with black, merry eyes.
My wife, Belle says in his cracked voice, dead these many years, and how I miss her. Welcome to our home, Miss Gibney.
He rolls his chair toward her, wheezing with the effort it takes, but when the grandson moves forward to help, Belle waves him off. He holds out a hand which arthritis has turned into a driftwood sculpture. She shakes it with care.
Have you had lunch? Brad Bell asks.
Yes, Holly says, a hastily gobbled chicken salad sandwich on the short ride from her hotel to this fashionable neighborhood.
Would you like tea or coffee? Oh, and we have pastries from 2 fat cats. They are excellent.
Tea would be wonderful, Holly says. Decaf, if you have it, and I'd love a pastry.
I want tea and a turnover, the old man says. Apple or blueberry, doesn't matter which, and I want real tea.
Coming right up, Brad says, and leaves him. Dan Bell immediately leans forward, eyes fixed on Holly's, and says in a low, conspiratorial voice, Brad's terribly gay, you know.
Oh, Holly says. She can think of nothing else to say except, I was pretty sure he was, and that seems rude.
Terribly gay, but he's a genius. He's helped me with my researches. I can be sure, I have been sure, but Brad's the one who provided the proof. He wags a finger at her, marking off each syllable. Incontrovertible.
Holly nods and sits in a wing chair, knees together and purse on her lap. She's starting to think that Belle actually is in the grip of a neurotic fantasy and she's running up a blind alley. This doesn't irritate or exasperate her. On the contrary, it fills her with relief. Because if he is, she probably is too.
Tell me about your creature, Dan says, leaning even further forward. In his article, Dr. Morton says you call it an outsider.
Those bright, exhausted eyes are still fixed on hers. Holly thinks of a cartoon vulture sitting on a tree branch. Although it once would have been difficult for Holly not to do what people asked her to do, almost impossible, she shakes her head. He sits back in his wheelchair, disappointed.
No.
You already have most of my story from the article Dr. Morton published in Psychiatric Quarterly and from videos you may have seen on the internet. I came to hear your story. You called Andowski a thing, an it. I want to know how you can be so sure he's an outsider.
Outsider is a good name for him. Very good.
Belle straightens his cannula, which has come askew.
A very good name. I'll tell you, over our tea and pastries. We'll have them upstairs in Brad's workroom. I'll tell you everything. You'll be convinced. Oh, yes.
Brad?
Brad knows everything,
Dan says, waving that driftwood hand dismissively.
A good boy, gay or not.
Holly has time to muse that when you're in your 90s, even men 20 years older than Brad Bell must seem like boys.
A smart boy, too. And you don't have to tell me your story if you don't want to. Although I would love for you to fill in certain details I'm curious about. But before I tell you what I know, I must insist that you tell me what caused you to suspect Andowski in the first place.
This is a reasonable request, and she runs down her reasoning, such as it is.
Mostly, it was that little spot of hair
beside his mouth that kept bugging me, she finishes.
It was as if he put on a false mustache and was in such a hurry when he peeled it off that he didn't get all of it. Only if he could change his whole physical appearance, why would he even need a false mustache?
Belle waves his hand dismissively.
Did your outsider have facial hair?
Holly thinks, frowning. The first person the outsider impersonated that she knew of, an orderly named Heath Holmes, didn't. The second one didn't have face hair either. His third target had a goatee, but when Holly and Ralph confronted the outsider in the Texas cave, his transformation hadn't been complete.
I don't think so. What are you saying?
I don't think they can grow facial hair, Dan Bell says. I think if you saw your outsider naked, I assumed you never did.
No, Holly says, and because she can't help it, ugh.
That makes Dan smile.
If you had, I think you would have seen no pubic hair and clean armpits.
The thing we met in that cave had hair on his head. So does Andowski. So did George.
George?
What I call the man who delivered the package with the bomb in it to the MacReady school.
George, huh?
I see.
Dan appears to meditate on this for a moment. A little smile touches the corners of his mouth, then it fades.
Head hair's different, though, isn't it? Children have hair on their heads before puberty. Some are born with hair on their heads.
Holly sees his point and hopes it really is a point and not just another facet of this old man's delusion.
There are other things the bomber, George, if you like, can't change the way he changes his physical appearance, Dan says. He needed to put on a fake uniform and wear fake glasses. He needed a fake truck and a fake package reader. And he needed a fake mustache.
Ondowski may also have fake eyebrows, Brad says, coming in with a tray. On it are two mugs of tea and a pile of turnovers. But probably not. I've studied pictures of him until my eyes are practically rolling down my cheeks. I think he may have had implants to normalize what would otherwise have just been fuzz, the way baby eyebrows are just fuzz. He bends to put the tray on the coffee table.
No, no, your workroom, Dan says. Time to get this show on the road. Miss Gibney, Holly, will you push me? I'm rather tired.
Of course. They pass a formal dining room and a cavernous kitchen. At the end of the hall is a stair chair, which runs up to the second floor on a steel rail. Holly hopes it's more reliable than the elevator in the Frederick building.
Brad had this put in when I lost the use of my legs, Dan says.
Brad hands Holly the tray and transfers the old man to the stair chair with the ease of long practice. Dan pushes a button and begins to rise. Brad takes the tray back, and he and Holly walk along beside the chair, which is slow but sure. This is a very nice house, Holly says. Must have been expensive, is the unspoken corollary. Dan, nevertheless, reads her mind.
Grandfather, pulp and paper mills.
The penny drops for Holly. The supply closet at Finders Keepers is stacked with Bell copier paper. Dan sees her face and smiles.
Yes, that's right. Bell Paper Products, now part of an overseas conglomerate that kept the name. Until the 1920s, my grandfather owned mills all over western Maine. Lewiston, Lisbon Falls, Jay, Mechanic Falls, all shuttered now, or turned into shopping malls. He lost most of his fortune in the crash of 29 and the Depression. That was the year I was born. No life of Riley for my father or me. We had to work for our beer and Skittles, but we managed to keep the house.
On the second floor, Brad transfers Dan to another wheelchair and hooks him up to another bottle of oxygen. This floor seems to consist of one large room where the December sunlight has been forbidden to enter. The windows have been covered with blackout curtains. There are four computers on two work desks, several gaming consoles that look state-of-the-art to Holly, a ton of audio equipment, and a gigantic flat-screen TV. Several speakers have been mounted on the walls. Two more flank the TV on either side.
Put the tray down, Brad, before you spill everything.
The table, Dan indicates with one of his arthritic hands, is covered with computing magazines, several of them copies of sound file, which Holly has never heard of, flash drives, external hard drives, and cables. Holly starts trying to clear a place.
Oh, just put all that rickrack on the floor, Dan says.
She looks at Brad, who nods apologetically. I'm a little messy, he says. When the tray is safely in place, Brad puts pastries on three plates. They look delicious, but Holly no longer knows if she's hungry or not. She's starting to feel like Alice at the Mad Hatter's tea party. Dan Bell takes a sip from his cup, smacks his lips, then grimaces and places a hand on the left side of his shirt. Brad is at his side immediately. Do you have your pills, Grandpa?
Yes, yes, Dan says and pats the side pocket of his wheelchair. I'm all right. You can stop hovering. It's just the excitement of having someone in the house, someone who knows. It's probably good for me.
Not so sure about that, Grandpa, Brad says. Maybe you better take a pill.
I'm fine, I said.
Mr. Bell, Holly begins.
Dan, the old man says, once more wagging his finger, which is grotesquely bent with arthritis, but still admonitory. I'm Dan. He's Brad. You're Holly. We're all friends here.
He laughs again. This time it sounds out of breath. You have to slow down, Brad says, unless you want another trip to the hospital, that is.
Yes, Mother. Dan says.
He cups a hand over his beak of a nose and takes several deep breaths of oxygen.
Now give me one of those turnovers. And we need napkins.
But there are no napkins.
I'll get some paper towels from the bathroom, Brad says, and off he goes. Dan turns to Holly.
Terribly forgetful. Terribly. Where was I? Does it even matter?
Does any of this? Holly wonders.
I was telling you that my father and I had to work for a living. Did you see the pictures downstairs?
Yes, Holly says. Yours, I assume.
Yes, yes, all mine.
He holds up his twisted hands.
Before this happened to me.
They're very good, Holly says.
Not so bad, he says. Although the ones in the hall aren't the best. Those were for work. Brad put them up. Insisted. I also did some paperback covers back in the 50s and 60s for publishers like Gold Medal and Monarch. They were much better. Crime, mostly. Half-dressed babes with smoking automatics. They brought in a little extra. Ironic, when you think about my full-time job. I was with the Portland PD. Retired at 68. Did my 40 and four more.
Not just an artist, but another cop, Holly thinks. First Bill, then Pete, then Ralph, and now him. She once more thinks of how some force, invisible but strong, seems to be pulling her into this, quietly insisting on parallels and continuations.
My grandfather was a mill-owning capitalist, but since then we've all been blue. Dad was police, and I followed in his footsteps, as my son followed in mine. Brad's father, I'm speaking of, he died in a crash while chasing a man, probably drunk, driving a stolen car. That man lived, may be living today for all I know.
I'm very sorry, Holly says. Dan ignores her effort at condolence.
Even Brad's mother was in the family trade. Well, in a way, she was a court stenographer. When she died, I took the boy in. I don't care if he's gay or not, nor does the police department. Although he doesn't work for them full time, with him it's more of a hobby. Mostly he does this.
He waves his deformed hand at the computer equipment. I design audio for games, Brad says quietly. The music, the effects, the mix. He has returned with a whole roll of paper towels. Holly takes two and spreads them on her lap. Dan goes on, seemingly lost in the past.
After my radio car days were over, I never rose to detective, never wanted to. I worked mostly in dispatch. Some cops don't like riding a desk, but I never minded, because I had another job as well. One that kept me busy long after retirement. You could say that's one side of the coin. What Brad does when they call him in is the other side. Between the two of us, Holly, we nailed this, pardon my French, this shitbag. He's been in our sights for years.
Holly has finally taken a bite of her turnover, but now opens her mouth, allowing an unsightly shower of crumbs to fall to the plate and paper towels in her lap.
Years?
Yes, Dan says. Brad's known since he was in his 20s. He's worked on this with me since 2005 or so. Isn't that right, Brad?
A little later, Brad says, after swallowing a bite of his own turnover. Dan shrugs. It looks painful.
It all starts to melt together when you're my age, he says,
then turns what's almost a glare on Holly. His bushy eyebrows, no faking there, draw together.
But not with Ondowski, as he's now calling himself. On him, I'm crystal clear. Right back to the beginning, or at least to where I came in. We've arranged quite a show for you, Holly. Brad, is that first video queued up?
Already, Grandpa.
Brad grabs his iPad and uses a remote to turn on the big TV.
It's currently showing nothing but a blue screen and the word ready. Holly hopes she is. 10.
I was 31 when I first saw him, Dan says. I know that because my wife and boy had a little birthday party for me just a week before. It seems like a long time ago, and it seems like no time at all. I was still on radio cars then. Marcel Duchamp and I were parked just off Marginal Way, behind a snowbank, and waiting for speeders, not very likely on a weekday morning, eating crullers, drinking coffee. I remember Marcel was ribbing me about some paperback cover I'd done, asking how my wife liked me painting pictures of hot women in their undies. I think I was just telling him that his wife had posed for that one when the guy ran up to the car and knocked on the driver's side window.
He pauses, shakes his head. You always remember where you were when you get bad news, don't you? Holly thinks of the day she found out that Bill Hodges was gone. Jerome made that call, and she was pretty sure he'd been choking back tears.
Marcel rolled his window down and asked the guy if he needed help. He said no. He had a transistor radio. That was what we had instead of iPods and cell phones back in those days, and asked if we'd heard about what just happened in New York.
Dan pauses to straighten his cannula and adjust the flow of oxygen from the tank on the side of his chair.
We hadn't heard anything except for what was on the police radio, so Marcel turned that off and turned on the regular one. Found the news. This is what the Jaga was talking about. Go ahead and run the first one, Brad.
Dan's grandson has his electronic tablet on his lap. He pokes at it and says to Holly, I'm going to mirror this to the big screen. 1 second. Okay, here we go. On the screen, to somber music, comes the title card of an old-time newsreel. Worst air crash in history, it reads. What follows is crisp black-and-white footage of a city street that looks like a bomb hit it. The terrible aftermath of the worst air disaster in history, the announcer intones. In a Brooklyn street lies the shattered remnant of a jet transport that collided with another airliner in murky New York skies. On the tail of the plane are what remains of it. Holly can read UNIT. The United Airlines aircraft plummeted into a brownstone residential section, killing 6 on the ground, as well as 84 passengers and the crew. Now Holly sees firemen in old-fashioned helmets rushing through the wreckage. Some are carrying stretchers to which are strapped blanket-covered bodies. Normally, the announcer continues, this United flight and the Trans World Airlines flight it collided with would have been separated by miles. But the TWA plane, Flight 266, carrying 44 passengers and crew, was far off course. It crashed on Staten Island. More covered bodies on more stretchers. A huge airplane wheel, the rubber shredded and still smoking. The camera pans the wreckage of 266, and Holly sees Christmas presents wrapped in gay paper scattered everywhere. The camera zooms in on one to show a little Santa Claus attached to the bow. Santa is smoldering and blackened with soot.
You can stop it there, Dan says.
Brad pokes his tablet and the big TV returns to blue screen. Dan turns to Holly.
134 dead in all. And when did it happen? December 16th, 1960. 60 years ago to this very day.
Only a coincidence, Holly thinks, but a chill shivers through her just the same. And once again, she thinks of how there may be forces in this world, moving people as they will, like men and women on a chessboard. The confluence of dates could be a coincidence,
But can she say that about all that's brought her here to this house in Portland, Maine? No. There's a chain going all the way back to another monster named Brady Hartsfield. Brady, who allowed her to believe in the first place.
There was one survivor, Dan Bell says, startling her out of her reverie.
Holly points at the blue screen as if the newsreel were still playing there. Someone survived that? Only for a day, Brad says. The newspapers called him the boy who fell from the sky.
But it was someone else who coined the phrase, Dan says. Back then in the New York metro area, there were 3 or 4 independent TV stations as well as the networks. One of them was WLPT. Long gone now, of course, but if something was filmed or taped, chances are good that you can find it on the Internet. Prepare yourself for a shock, young lady.
He nods at Brad, who begins poking at his tablet again. Holly learned at her mother's knee and with her father's tacit approval that overt displays of emotion weren't just embarrassing and unpleasant, but shameful. Even after years of work with Allie Winters, she usually keeps her feelings bottled up and tightly capped, even among friends. These are strangers, but when the next clip starts on the big screen, she screams. She can't help it. That's him! That's Ondowski!
I know, Dan Bell says.
11. Only most people would say it wasn't, and Holly knows this. They'd say, oh yes, there's a resemblance, just as there's a resemblance between Mr. Bell and his grandson, or between John Lennon and his son Julian, or between me and Aunt Elizabeth. They'd say, I bet it's Chet Ondowski's grandfather. Gosh, the apple sure doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? But Holly, like the old man in the wheelchair, knows. The man holding the old-fashioned WLPT microphone is fuller in the face than Ondowski, and the lines on that face suggest he's 10, maybe even 20 years older. His crew cut is salt and pepper, and it comes to a slight widow's peak that Ondowski doesn't have. He has the beginning of jowls, and Ondowski doesn't have those either. Behind him, some firefighters scurry about in the sooty snow, picking up packages and luggage while others turn hoses on the remains of the United plane and 2 burning brownstones behind it. Just pulling away is a big old Cadillac of an ambulance with its lights flashing.
This is Paul Freeman, reporting from the Brooklyn site of the worst air crash in American history, the reporter says, puffing out white vapor with every word. All were killed on board this United Airlines jet, except for one boy.
He points to the departing ambulance.
The boy, as yet unidentified, is in that ambulance. He is,
the reporter calling himself Paul Freeman pauses dramatically,
the boy who fell from the sky. He was thrown from the rear section of the plane, still on fire, and landed in a snowbank. Horrified bystanders rolled him in the snow and put out the flames, but I saw him loaded into the ambulance, and I can tell you that his injuries looked severe. His clothes were almost entirely burned off or melted into his skin.
Stop it there, the old man commands.
His grandson does so. Dan turns to Holly. His blue eyes are faded, but still fierce.
Do you see it, Holly? Do you hear it? I'm sure to the viewing audience he just looked and sounded horrified doing his job under difficult conditions, but...
He's not horrified, Holly said. She's thinking of Ondowski's first report from the MacCready school bombing. Now she sees that with clear eyes. He's excited.
Yes, Dan says, and nods. Yes, indeed. You understand. Good.
Thank God someone else does, Brad says.
The boy's name was Stephen Baltz, Dan says, and this Paul Freeman saw the burned boy perhaps heard his screams of pain, because witnesses said the boy was conscious, at least to begin with. And do you know what I think, what I have come to believe? That he was feeding.
Of course he was, Holly says. Her lips feel numb. On the boy's pain, and on the horror of the bystanders. On the death.
Yes. Get ready for the next one, Brad.
Dan sits back in his chair, looking tired. Holly doesn't care. She needs to know the rest. She needs to know everything. The old fever is on her. When did you go looking for this? How did you find out?
I first saw the clip you just watched the evening of the crash on the Huntley-Brinkley report.
He sees her puzzlement and smiles a little.
You're too young to remember Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. It's now called NBC Nightly News.
Brad says, if an indie station arrived at some big news event first and got good footage, they'd sell the report to one of the networks. That's what must have happened with this and how Grandpa got to see it. Freeman got there first, Holly muses. Are you saying, do you think Freeman caused those planes to crash?
Dan Bell shakes his head so emphatically that the cobwebby remains of his hair fly. No, just struck lucky, or played the odds, because there are always tragedies in big cities, aren't there? Chances for a thing like him to feed. And who knows? A creature like him may be attuned to the approach of major disasters. Maybe he's like a mosquito. They can smell blood from miles away, you know. How can we know when we don't even know what he is? Run the next one, Brad.
Brad starts the clip, and the man who comes on the big screen is once more Ondowski. But he's different. Thinner. Younger than Paul Freeman. And younger than the version of Ondowski doing his report near the blown-out side of the MacCready School. But it's him. The face is different. The face is the same. The microphone he's holding has the letters KTVT attached to it. Three women are standing with him. One of them is wearing a Kennedy political button. Another has a placard, crumpled and somehow forlorn, that reads, All the Way with JFK in 64.
This is Dave Van Pelt, reporting from Dealey Plaza, across from the Texas School Book Depository, where...
Freeze it, Dan says, and Brad does. Dan turns to Holly. It's him again, right?
Yes, Holly says. I'm not sure anyone else would see it. I'm not sure how you saw it so long after the plane crash report, but it is. My father once told me something about cars. He said the companies, Ford, Chevrolet, Chrysler, offer lots of different models, and they change them from year to year, but they're all from the same template. He, Ondowski.
But words fail her, and she can only point to the black and white image on the screen. Her hand is trembling.
Yes, Dan says softly. Very well put. He's different models, but from the same template. Except there are at least two templates, maybe more.
What do you mean?
I'll get to that.
His voice is rustier than ever, and he drinks some more tea to lubricate it.
I only saw this report by chance because I was a Huntley-Brinkley man when it came to the evening news. But after Kennedy was shot, everyone turned over to Walter Cronkite, including me. Because CBS had the best coverage. Kennedy was shot on a Friday. This report was on the CBS Evening News the following day, the Saturday. What news people call a backgrounder. Go ahead, Brad, but take it from the top.
The young reporter in the horrible plaid sport coat begins again.
This is Dave Van Pelt, reporting from Dealey Plaza, across from the Texas School Book Depository, where John F. Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States, was fatally shot yesterday. I'm here with Greta Dyson, Monica Kellogg, and Juanita Alvarez.
Kennedy, supporters who were right here where I'm standing when the shots were fired. Ladies, can you tell me what you saw? Miss Dyson.
Shots. Blood. There was blood from the back of his poor head.
Greta Dyson is weeping so hard she can barely be understood, which Holly supposes is sort of the point. Viewers at home are probably weeping right along with her, thinking that her grief stands for theirs and for the grief of a nation. Only the reporter...
He's eating it up, she says, just pretending to be concerned, and not doing a very good job of it at that.
Absolutely, Dan says. Once you look at it the right way, it's impossible to miss. And look at the other two ladies. They're crying, too. Hell, a lot of people were crying that Saturday. And in the weeks that followed, you're right. He's eating it up.
And you think he knew it was going to happen? Like a mosquito smelling blood?
I don't know, Dan says. I just don't know.
We do know he only started working at KTVT that summer, Brad says. I wasn't able to find out much about him, but that much I did get. From a history of the station on the internet. And he was gone by the spring of 1964.
The next time he turns up, that I know about anyway, is in Detroit, Dan says. 1967, during what was known at the time as the Detroit Rebellion or the 12th Street Riot. It started when the police raided an after-hours bar, so-called Blind Pig, and spread citywide. 43 killed, 1,200 injured. It was the top news story for 5 days, which was how long the violence went on. This is from another independent station, but it got picked up by NBC and ran on the nightly news. Go ahead, Brad.
A reporter is standing in front of a burning storefront, interviewing a black man with blood running down his face. The man is almost incoherent with grief. He says that's his dry cleaning business burning down across the way, and he doesn't know where his wife and daughter are. They have disappeared into the citywide melee.
I've lost everything, he says. Everything.
And the reporter, this time calling himself Jim Avery?
He's a small city TV guy for sure. Stouter than Paul Freeman.
Verging on fat and short, his interviewee towers over him. And balding. Different model. Same template. It's Chet Ondowski buried in that fat face. It's also Paul Freeman. And Dave Van Pelt.
How did you tip to this, Mr. Bell? How in heaven's name?
Dan, remember. It's Dan.
How could you see the resemblance? It wasn't just a resemblance.
Dan and his grandson look at each other and exchange a smile. Holly, watching this momentary byplay, thinks again. Different models, same template.
You noticed the pictures in the hall, right? Brad asks. That was Grandpa's other job when he was on the cops. He was a natural for it.
Once again, the penny drops. Holly turns to Dan.
You were a sketch artist. That was your other police job.
Yes, although I did a lot more than sketch. I was no cartoonist. I did portraits. He thinks, then adds, you've heard people say they never forget a face. Mostly they're exaggerating or outright lying. I'm not.
The old man speaks matter-of-factly. If it's a gift, Holly thinks, it's as old as he is. Maybe once it blew his mind, now he takes it for granted.
I've seen him work, Brad says. If not for the arthritis in his hands, he could turn around, face the wall, and do you in 20 minutes, Holly, and every detail would be right. Those pictures in the hall, all people who were caught based on Grandpa's portraits.
Still, she begins doubtfully.
To remember faces is only part of it, Dan says. It doesn't help when it comes to getting a likeness of a perpetrator, because I'm not the one who saw him, you understand?
Yes, Holly says. She's interested in this for reasons other than his ID of Ondowski in his many different guises. She's interested in it because in her own work as an investigator, she is still learning.
The witness comes in some cases, like a carjacking or robbery, several witnesses come in. They describe the doer, only it's like the blind men with the elephant. You know that story?
Polly does. The blind man who grabs the tail says it's a vine. The one who grabs the trunk thinks it's a python. The one who grabs the leg is sure it's the bole of a big old palm tree. Eventually, the blind men get into a brawl about who is right.
Every witness sees the guy in a slightly different way, Dan says. And if it's one witness, he or she sees him in different ways on different days. No, no, they say. I was wrong. The face is too fat. It's too thin. He had a goatee. No, it was a mustache. His eyes were blue. No, I slept on it, and I guess they were actually gray.
He takes another long pull of O2, looking more tired than ever, except for the eyes in their purple pouches. They are bright, focused. Holly thinks that if the Ondowski thing saw those eyes, he might be afraid. Might want to shut them before they saw too much.
My job is to look past all the variations and see the similarities. That's the real gift and what I put in my pictures. It's what I put in my first pictures of this guy. Look.
From the side pocket of his chair, he takes a small folder and hands it to her. Inside are half a dozen pieces of thin drawing paper going brittle with age. There's a different version of Charles Chet Ondowski on each one. They are not as detailed as his rogues gallery in the front hall, but they are still extraordinary. In the first three, she's looking at Paul Freeman, Dave Van Pelt, and Jim Avery. Did you draw these from memory? She asks.
Yes, Dan says, again not boasting, just stating a fact. Those first three were drawn soon after I saw Avery, summer of 67. I've made copies, but those are the originals.
Brad says, remember the time frame, Holly. Grandpa saw these men on TV before VCRs, DVRs, or the internet. For ordinary viewers, you saw what you saw, and then it was gone. He had to rely on memory. And these others, she spread out the other three like a fan of cards, faces with different hairlines, different eyes and mouths, different lines, different ages, all different models from the same template, all Ondowski. She can see it because she's seen the elephant. That Dan Bell saw it back in the day is amazing. Genius, really. He points to the drawing she's holding. One after another.
That one's Reginald Holder. He reported from Westfield, New Jersey, after John List killed his whole family. Interviewed sobbing friends and neighbors. The next one is Harry Vale reporting from Cal State Fullerton after a janitor named Edward Alloway shot and killed 6 people. Vale was on the scene before the blood was dry, interviewing survivors. The last one, his name escapes me.
Fred Liebermanenbach, Brad says, correspondent for WKS Chicago. He covered the Tylenol poisonings in 1982. 7 people died. Talked to grieving relatives. I have all these video clips if you want to see them.
He's got plenty of clips. We've uncovered 17 different versions of your Chet Ondowski, Dan says.
17? Holly is flabbergasted.
Those are just the ones we know of. No need to look at all of them. Slide those first three drawings together and hold them up to the TV, Holly. It's not a light box, but it should do.
She holds them in front of the blue screen, knowing what she'll see. It's one face. Ondowski's face. An outsider.